Welcome to episode 3 of the NASCAR and NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan. I'm just back from Daytona International Speedway, where I was privileged to be one of roughly 101,000 or so who saw the thrilling finish to the 58th running of the Daytona 500. It was the closest finish of the Great American Race in history. Of course, Denny Hamlin nipping Martin Truex Jr. at the line and capping Speed Week's 2016. And both of our guests this week have a connection to the preceding 2 weeks in Daytona. Parker Kligerman is an NBC Sports analyst. He also is a NASCAR driver. He finished third in Friday's truck race. It was his first truck start since 2014, and it was a great kickoff to a season with a new team after spending much of 2015 out of NASCAR doing some work for us. He's going to do both this year, appearing on NASCAR America and driving the truck. So he's our first guest today. It was a good conversation with Parker about his return to NASCAR, the peaks and valleys that he's had professionally over the past few years, and we also recap his view of the Daytona 500. Our second guest is Ed Clark, president of Atlanta Motor Speedway, which of course hosts this Sunday's Sprint Cup race, and he's certainly hoping for a big crowd building off the momentum of that thrilling finish at Daytona. So we've got lots of Parker and Ed Clark ahead, so we're going to dive right into it. Many thanks to everyone who makes this show possible. Always seeking feedback, of course. I'm on Twitter, at Nate Ryan. So any suggestions, any guest ideas or discussion topics that you'd like to see, please send me a tweet, at Nate Ryan. And without further ado, here's NASCAR driver and NBC Sports analyst, Parker Kligerman. All right, now joined by Parker Kligerman, who comes off of a third-place finish in the Camping World Truck Series opener at Daytona National Speedway. Parker, first of all, thanks for being here. Second, let's start there. I mean, how did it feel to be back in a NASCAR race after starting only one in 2015? I'm sure, regardless of that top five, I'm sure it just felt great to be back at the track.
Yeah, I actually, my personal Facebook to my friends and family, I said, hey, not bad for a hiatus of a bit. So it just felt good to be going fast. I mean, that's the best thing I can say about it. In so many respects, Daytona and Talladega are races that are big races. You know, some drivers look forward to them, some absolutely dread them. I'm one of those ones that looks forward to them, the Super Speedway races, and to have an opportunity to go out there and just race and be in a position where, you know, with the truck team I was at, with Ricky Benton Racing, we had some amazing sponsors, Valvoline, Advanced Auto Parts, major brand names on our truck supporting it. And that was cool because, you know, I did have a bit of a hiatus. So I felt like a race car driver again. In the time I've been off here, you know, I've almost, I don't like to use the word journalist because the journalists out there are far more talented and impressive at doing what we do than myself. But, you know, I definitely had to switch mindsets and being more an analyst of the sport and trying to, you know, view the sport from the top down and take a whole nother perspective. And it felt great, aside from the finish, just to go out there and be a race car driver for a weekend. And that was really cool. I just, I almost got a little nostalgic at times, you know, and just doing the autograph session and getting out of practice and just, you know, working with my crew chief to make the truck better. And that sort of thing just felt cool to, you know, everything you did as a young kid and moving up the ranks. You always did that week in, week out, and you kind of took it for granted. And to get back in there and do that again, I had a massive appreciation for just getting the chance to be there, which I think, you know, especially come the time I was getting in the cup and such, you know, you'd lose that when you think you're so focused on your career and what you're going to achieve and sponsorship and, you know, bringing funding and or finding or raising the profile of the team you're at and that sort of thing. It felt cool, as I said, just to be a race car driver again.
Yeah, and I'm sure, obviously, as we just discussed, I mean, you gain appreciation for that when you go through a season like you went through last year. And I know that you touched on this after the race Friday, and again, I apologize for being remiss and not hearing this in person, but if you could
No, I'm really upset about you not being there.
No, call me out next time.
No, I've tallied it, and we'll just see how far that goes season, when you're there or not.
I got to start keeping a wallet-sized schedule of all of your truck races this year so that I plan out my calendar so I'm there every time. But let's recap that. I mean, you again expounded on this Friday, but what was it like last year? You make the move over to NBC Sports and doing a lot of analysis on NASCAR America. Did you have to? I think you talked about this, about how Brian Vickers had said he was at peace with maybe never driving again if it came to that. Did you kind of have that internal monologue with yourself?
I think you have to, you know, and sometimes even if you yourself don't want to bring it up, others will bring it up for you. And that's the funniest thing that happened to me is that, okay, you know, I guess the best thing to do is kind of take it a little bit through that time frame is that, you know, as April 2014 came around, I knew our team was struggling. I knew we were in a tight position. But did I think we were going to completely fold? No, not really. I thought, you know, in some capacity, myself, Brendan Davis, Swan would continue to race so that we could get back to being a full-time team in 2015. Obviously, that didn't happen, and I was actually at home in April right after our team folded, and I got a call from Kurt Busch, and out of the blue, and he said, hey, Parker, this is the kind of call you want to get, and it was to go be his backup driver for the Indy 500 that he did with the Coke 600. So that was an amazing experience, but while I was down there, I got another mysterious call from a number I'd never seen. When I answered the phone, it was a man named Jeff Mankey, who obviously you know well. He's the head of NASCAR at NBC Sports. And he said to me, hey, your name came up, in discussion with our producers and such, as someone that you would be interested to come do a little TV. And I said, you know what? I've had two or three opportunities come to me in the Cup Series in that time that were, you know, less than something I was interested in a lot of ways. You know, it felt like they were opportunities to stay in a race car, but they weren't opportunities to continue the growth of my career or really do anything that was going to put me on a trajectory to get to the type of ride I wanted to get to. And suddenly I had this opportunity at NBC, and so I said, you know what, Jeff, where are you guys at? And he said, Stamford, Connecticut. And I grew up in Stamford until I was 12 years old. I lived in Stamford, and then my family moved about 30 minutes north to Westport. So I said, you know what, my lease was up on my place in North Carolina. I'm coming home. And it was kind of one of those off-the-cuff decisions. I didn't give it a lot of thought. I just thought, you know what, life takes you so many ways. I was a little distraught with some things that happened that time, obviously, in the sport. And so I said, I'm leaving. I'm going north. And when I got here, I found a very welcoming place at NBC Sports, a place that was, you know, very interested in being progressive about, you know, trying to find a younger audience for our sport, trying to find new ways to bring our sport to our current audience and to really find ways to develop a whole new rhetoric around our sport. And I really kind of got interested in that and felt sort of at home in a lot of ways. And, you know, come 2015, I started to get the itch for sure, you know, wanting to be in a race car. I had some great people working me, trying to get me in a race car, but just nothing could seem to materialize. And I definitely feel like, you know, like Brian Vickers said, it came to a point where you think, man, I'm not going to drive a race car again. Like, this is kind of it. This is what, you know, you got to make peace with it. If you do get to drive a race car again, it's not going to be as a professional driver. You know, you're going to have to find ways to get back in race cars, maybe in fun events and such, but you're not going to be a professional race car driver again. And it's a tough thing to swallow. And at first, I think you kind of have the mindset of, like, I'm going to make it whatever else I do. And then there's the dark days where you kind of look back too much and start to get really nostalgic. And then there's the days where you know, people continue to ask you, like, hey, man, why aren't you in a race car? Hey, get in a race car. You know, like, it's not that easy. So I definitely think, you know, you go through all those ranges of motion, and then, as I said, just to have the chance I did have to get back in a race car, really kind of put all that aside, and it just felt great to be a race car driver. And I'm really excited about kind of mixing the two. As I said down there, I've almost got a day job and a weekend job now, and that's one of the coolest things ever.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think you are in a really unique position, especially given your age. I think that bodes well for you, regardless of how things turn out driving-wise. Certainly, Connecticut being home, that makes it a little bit easier, but that's still a very bold move, because you hear often out of sight, out of mind when people talk about race car drivers. Did you have fears that making that leap would be an impediment to maybe trying to get back in the car? Did you know that you'd still be able to find rides from afar?
Oh, man, you know, that was like the number one saying said to me every 5 seconds from anyone that was involved with me in the racing side. But you know what? I felt like doing the TV thing, you know, in this day and age, I want to say this the correct way, because I think, you know, if I say it the wrong way, fans will interpret that it's not about talent. But obviously, there's things you can do in our sport, no matter how talented you are, to help yourself have a more solid footing in the sport, or have a chance at a better ride or a chance at a better situation, and that is to make yourself a bigger name, to be more marketable, to be more in the face of sponsors and things that you can do for them that others can't. That's just the nature of the game. It doesn't mean that you only need to do that. No, you need to be able to drive a race car. You need to be good at driving a race car if you want to win races. If you want to get to one of the top teams, you have to be one of the best. But if you want to actually get in the show, if you want to be there, if you want to have that chance or give yourself a better chance, you've got to do things that could hopefully separate you from the rest of the pack. And I felt like if I couldn't be in a race car winning races, then the TV thing was something that kind of separated me from the rest of the pack. At 23 years old, to be on national television talking about our sport in a different way, I felt like that was going to do something better for me. And since it's happened, it definitely has. I feel like I was walking around Daytona, I told a lot of people, I've never been stopped so many times in my street clothes by fans and other people yeah. throughout the sport talking about what we do on TV and what some things they like, some things they want us to do better, this, that, that, and how much they thought it was cool that we were doing. I was doing both, and I thought that was a really amazing thing.
Yeah, I've been stopped once or twice too, and it's a rather unnerving experience. The first time it happens, I can relate as somebody who doesn't actually.
They should know Nate Ryan. That's you've been on the forefront of it for many years. So.
Yeah. Well, they're probably stopping me for different reasons than when they stopped you. and rightfully so after your performance Friday night. And I know that obviously you did a great job throughout that race to be there at the end, which they always talk about in plate racing. But I'd like to just focus on that last lap because so much what was made of it. Take us through it. I mean, how did you survive all the chaos and get to third?
Well, I closed my eyes and held the throttle down, like we all do.
That's the secret.
That's the big secret of Super Speedways. No, I'd say, I was sitting under the red flag there, and it was the funniest thing. I saw there was a truck in front of us, and it was Ben Rhodes. He had a tire down. The 88 of Matt Crafton's truck was completely damaged, and ours was fine. The only thing I was wondering is if we ran over any debris, and thankfully we didn't. But therefore, I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at the trucks ahead of it, and I'm like, oh, we're going to restart around fifth, I think. And in being fifth, I know how, you basically know how these sorts of restarts go. I'm going to push the 17, who's in third, I believe, who's going to push the 81, who's going to start on the bottom, and we'll clear that outside line, but soon that outside line will most definitely get a run. And I thought in my head, I said, Johnny Sauter's going to be the one I'm going to have to make the decision while I'm on the bottom of moving up or not moving up. And sure enough, we're coming to the white flag, and here we are for 3 and 4, and we've cleared the 21, and I'm pushing the 17 and the 81, but the 17 kept kind of backing up to me, but I believe he was scared of getting penalized for pushing, which, to be honest, I wasn't paying much attention to, because I felt like if they penalized the third-place truck,
right.
It would be impossible for them to penalize the third-place truck for pushing, since it was someone pushing me. So I felt like that was going to be a tough one, but definitely for the 17, he was worried about that. And so it kind of backed our line up, and sure enough, here comes the 21, and I hesitated for that slight second to think, is he coming too fast? I'm with a team that only has 3 full-time employees. This is their only Super Speedway truck. If I move up and wreck this truck trying to get the win, then instead of most likely getting the top 5 if I just stay where I'm at, I know it's not what you want to hear out of a race car driver, and I don't like to hear it. I don't even like to say what I'm saying right now, but I definitely, kind of took the better part of valor and stuck on the bottom, and then sure enough, we're coming off through the tri-oval, and all I saw was the 4 kind of just turn into the 17, and then I just turned left, trying to avoid it all, and we got lucky to move out of the way and finish third. So I've been kicking myself for not moving up, but at the same token, understanding our position as a race team, just really wasn't in the cards to go and risk wrecking that truck to win a race over finishing top 5. It just, it would have done more hurt to our race team, maybe stopped us from going to Atlanta. Maybe, now that we have this clean Super Speedway truck, I can convince Ricky Benton and all our great partners to go race Talladega. So I think it does a lot more good things for us for the long term than it does to go get that win.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think you have to apologize for virtually anything you do when it comes to plate racing, because it puts drivers in such untenable positions compared to any other races, and the consequences can be dire. Go ahead.
Well, I do have to say congrats to Johnny Sauter. He was the one who pushed me to my win at Talladega in 2012.
Oh, yeah.
So he and I, we've been at those positions a lot at the end of these Super Speedway races. I always feel like he's a great Super Speedway racer, and I pride myself on enjoying Super Speedway racing to hopefully make it to the end. And so I seem to always be around him at the end of this thing, so it's cool to see him get a win.
He certainly has got the experience to get there. But, of course, as you and Sauter crossed the line, everybody's eyes were riveted on the truck of Christopher Bell, of course. What is that? I mean, did you see that developing as you're taking the checkered? And you know, what kind of emotions do you have there? Like, where, hey, you're finishing top five for the first time, I think, in 3 years. It's a big moment for you, and then you're seeing this truck barrel rolling down the front stretch. It must be unnerving and, you know, enjoyable or whatever, all at the same time.
Well, you know, immediately you, as bad as it sounds, you think about your position and trying to protect your truck. And then, you know, as I looked behind, I saw him tumbling in my mirror. Because all I could see when he went up is that it was very reminiscent of 2012 with Joey Coulter when he went into the fence in the Stivel at the end of the race. And it really is, when you see the underside of a truck, you know something bad has happened there. So immediately as we were coming down the back stretch, which for us, you know, where we weren't going to get hit or anything. I came over and said, hey, I hope they're all right there because it looked pretty nasty. And, I mean, that's where your mind goes is, okay, at the end of the day, we're all very much competitors. We're racing tooth and nail at 200 miles an hour, you know, bumping each other, trying to gain an inch here and there at all costs. But when you see someone go through something as horrific as that, you know, immediately you become human again and think, okay, I hope he's all right. And glad to see him walk away. I will say, though, Christopher Bell coming from sprints and midgets, I think is pretty used to flipping, considering that, you know,
good point.
Those guys flip about every week, and at their biggest race, the Chili Bowl, they've got a foot count. So yep. I think he's if there's anyone that could go through that and not feel too scared, it was him.
Yeah, well, we're certainly happy that things turned out okay there. And, of course, your fortunes certainly turned with that finish. You mentioned Atlanta this weekend. What's ahead for you? How many races? And does this do anything to add races to your schedule?
Well, we did a great job getting Valvoline Advanced Auto Parts on the TV, so that was great. But we'll definitely go to Atlanta this weekend, which will be fun. And I think, you know, we have to temper our expectations there. And you know, if you look at this team's performance last year with the same mile and a half truck, they were able to run top 10. So if we can get a top 10, I think that's like a win. You know, they maybe ran more top 15 with a good strategy and such, can get in the top 10. So if we can do that, we're really doing a great job. You know, some of the intention and talk amongst our team has been to try to do the first six races. They're pretty spread out there, especially the first three, so it's very doable. And then kind of just take account where we're at and, you know, to see what the feeling is throughout the team. Ricky Benton, our owner, you know, our partners, et cetera, to say, hey, you know, do we want to continue on this week-to-week schedule, or do we, you know, start to say, hey, look, we could maybe, you know, save some money and cherry-pick our races and go out there and maybe run top five or fight for a win. And, you know, it's a decision of what we'll make as it comes along. But I think, you know, best thing I heard is Ricky Benton, our owner, said, hey, look, just take it week by week. We'll have some fun and see where we end up. So it's definitely a team that worked very hard. They work very hard with what they have. And you know, they've been Ricky Benton's been an ardent supporter of this series for a long time in a partial season capacity. I'd just love to be able to continue their progression from last year where they showed to be a top 10 team and hopefully move them to top five and maybe fight for a win here and there.
Yeah,
so we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, no question. Obviously, they're one of the smaller, lower budgeted teams on the circuit, so some tough decisions to make on the schedule. You alluded to it, Parker, three full-time employees. You've driven for Team Penske, you drove for. I mean, there are hundreds of full-time employees there. Can you even wrap your head around that difference, or is it something you just don't really pay attention to? It's just head down and, hey, this is my team. I'm going to try to do the best I can.
You know what I always say is that I'm very lucky and grateful for the spectrum I've been a part of in this sport at such a young age. You know, I've driven, as you said, for one of the preeminent teams and probably the top team in American motorsports, Penske Racing, or Team Penske, sorry, now. It was Penske. I keep screwing that one up because it was Penske Racing.
We all do it. No need to apologize.
Yeah, but then, you know, and then I've jumped all the way down to, you know, a team, not down, but I've moved over and jumped around and been in different situations throughout our sport, all the way to having a team like ourselves right now that has three full-time employees. You know, so it's just, it's one of those things that you're a racer. As you come up through the ranks, you drive for more things like I'm driving it now. You know, you only hope to get to something like Team Penske. But when you've kind of been there and then you can go back, you take a real appreciation for what they have and understand what they work on and what they do to get more performance. But it helps you realize what's important when you're on the small team. And that means that, you know, basically this isn't rocket science. You know, there's some basic principles on a race car that if you do the right things there, you can go get a good finish. It doesn't, to win a race, yes, all sorts of things start to pile up. Tiny little things, tiny small things that you only focus on when everything else is taken care of, when the budget's taken care of, when the picture's taken care of, then you can start to focus on these tiny little things that make huge differences between third and first, right? Fifth and first. But to go run top 10, there's some basic principles out there that you know you can do right. And since you've been at those big teams, you've seen what all those little things are, and you know now what exactly you don't need to focus on those. And that's what I think I can bring to these smaller teams and to be able to go out there and get finishes above maybe where our what our budget level says and that sort of thing, because I've seen that, I understand it, and you don't get stressed about it. You just go out there and do the best job you can.
Yeah, you certainly had more than a few starts there with Team Penske, and believe it or not, I was there. I don't know if many people know the full Parker Kligerman entrance into NASCAR, but I was there the day at Kansas Speedway in September of 2009 when your first race ever, you qualify on pole in the Xfinity Series debut there at Kansas Speedway. Not easy to do. And at the time, I mean, that was just when Penske was hiring Brad Keselowski full-time to drive next year. And I think at that point, people were talking about you, I don't want to say like in the same breath as Keselowski, but certainly they were saying, hey, they've just hired Keselowski. Here's this kid who just sat on the pole. Clearly a youth movement going on at Penske. And then kind of like the turning point, obviously the fortunes diverged and Brad went his way, and you have not had, unfortunately, the same breaks, the same success that he had. When you reflect back on that, what do you remember about those times, those days, and any regrets, any insight, anything you can tell us about like how things transpired where it just didn't quite work out the way you hoped?
Wow. Yeah. Well, I say all the time for athletes, you know, the best thing you have is a short-term memory.
Yeah.
because you want to move on from this, you know, the things that don't go your way, that hold you back, or, you know, could start to corrupt your mindset. But I'd say, you know, obviously I was very fortunate to rise the ranks of this sport very quickly. You know, I had only really started go-karting when I was 13 years old. And by the time I sat on that pole at the Nationwide race in 2009, I'd only done like 45 races my entire life.
Wow.
I didn't have the same upbringing that a lot of kids had, you know, where they went and raced 100 legend races or, you know, 50 late model races every year and just had all this. I was on a very stringent budget. My parents were only able to help me my first year in cars, and I was just amazingly lucky, basically, and blessed to get the chances I got so quickly, you know, with a limited amount of races. And so when I look at, you know, look back there, I was actually talking to Jerry Kelly. He's the two cars car chief at Team Penske. And he was kind of looking back the last year saying, like, man, how did you end up where you are right now? Like, he's like, you were really fast. You sat on the pole, all this stuff. I was like, hey, look, you know, I was also, I put it in the same vein as Joe Logano when he was at Joe Gibbs, although in a different vein. You know, when you enter an organization and you're merely 18 years old, and by the time, you know, 4 years later, you're still 22, you go through a massive transition as a person. You know, that's a very formative time in your life. Mm-hmm. And so you're sure to make mistakes. You're sure to make, you know, stupid kid mistakes, that sort of thing. And then at the same time, you're under a lot of pressure. You're under, you know, pressure to find funding and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, sometimes relationships can just get stale. You know, it becomes where you get to know each other so well that you almost lose that, you know, not belief, but you start to feel like, you know, you need a change of scenery. And you saw Joe Logano. I thought when he moved from JGR to Penske, I thought, wow, you know, he's going to be someone to be reckoned with because of that. You know, you could tell he had talent. The guy could win races. He could run up front, but there was something holding him back, something mental that was, you know, holding him from going out there and getting to his full potential. And I think when he had a change of scenery, people that believed him, a fresh start, he was able to go out there and really turn up the wick. And I think for myself, you know, I wasn't at the same level, so it was hard to leave an organization and get the same opportunities. But it definitely felt like, you know, when I was able to kind of get out of, and I don't want to say get out of there because there was a lot of great people there, a lot of people that supported me. I'm still friends with basically everyone to that organization. It just felt like with a change of scenery, you know, we were able to go out there and start to turn things on and to start to have more success when I was able to join up with Red Horse Racing and Toyota and that sort of thing, and felt like that was a positive. But, you know, at the end of the day, that was an amazing place to be a part of. I call it my college education because, you know, a lot of kids from 18 to 22 go to college. But I didn't have a formal college education, but I got a Penske education. And, you know, throughout business and life and racing, I've been able to learn a lot from that time there. And I'm very thankful for it. But it definitely, at times, makes you want to look back and think, oh, what could I have done this differently? Because, you know, what could I have done here or there? But really, you know, you got to look forward. You got to take from what you've, the good things that you had from that and move on. And one of my favorite quotes is actually from Conan O'Brien, who gave the commencement speech at Dartmouth a couple years ago. And it was about when he lost out on getting the Tonight Show, or actually was, you know, moved away from it. And he said something along the lines of, if you take your perceived failure and, you know what, let me look it up. Hold on, I'm going to get it right here because now we're sitting here. I want to get the exact quote because it's great. I have it written down. Hold on.
I understand.
Give me one second.
This
proves we do this on the cuff, but hold on here. Give me one second. I want to say this is one of the best quotes about this that I used from this time. It's our failure to become our perceived ideal that ultimately defines us and makes us unique. It's not easy, but if you accept your misfortune, handle it right, your perceived failure can become a catalyst for reinvention. And I really feel like, you know, you see that a lot of times in our sport for people that, you know, everything they've built up and everything they have perceived to be what they want, sometimes it takes it to another side, or even in life, and suddenly you find what you're really truly meant to be or part of or meant to do, and you feel more comfortable about it. And I think that's definitely something that, you know, we've seen and I felt in my past couple of years has really led to me where I am now, where I'm having a lot of fun, and as I like to say, I'm having a very dynamic life, having, you know, being a part of NBC and getting to race.
Yeah, yeah, well, you know, they say everything happens for a reason, which is a really simplistic way of saying what Conan Bryan said so eloquently, but I'm glad you brought that up. That's great words of wisdom. And we had Joey Logano on the podcast last week, and he had some similar perspective. I think you're right. I think that in some ways there definitely are some parallels there. You know, if nothing else, getting that education from Team Penske also earned you a golden ticket to their big gala in Charlotte last month, where you got to attend an event that had numerous Indy 500 winners, NASCAR champions, IndyCar champions. How was that? That must have been quite the night.
Well, as I was on that stage, there were about 40, I think it was 41 other drivers, and some Emerson Fittipaldi, David Hobbs, Jill DeFerrin, Rusty Wallace, Kurt Busch, Brad Keselowski. I turned to Justin Allgaier and I said, I think they have the wrong guy. I don't think I belong up here. But, you know, it was just a great honor. That was amazing. I think there was over 1,200 people or something there. It was just absolutely huge. It was massive. And it was really just amazing to see the lineage of this race team and you know, the impact it's had on racing. And you know, all very much a testament to Roger, though. I mean, the man is absolutely amazing. He's single-handedly built one of the largest corporations in America. He's built one of the, you know, preeminent race teams in America. And, you know, he's a nonstop go, go, go guy. His famous thing is, what's next? You know, if one thing's done, okay, what's next? He just never stops. So it was actually really cool, and I think a couple of drivers there mentioned it, was that to see Roger kind of reflect. And he doesn't like this sort of thing. He didn't want it to be about him. He's not a guy that wants, you know, the accolades on him. It's all about the team. But he actually, there was a time there where he was able to kind of reflect on what he's done and what he's built, and I thought that was really cool. So it was really, really amazing to be a part of, and I'll cherish that memory for a long time to come.
That's neat for you, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Bob Pockrass and I talked to Roger Penske on Saturday at Daytona, and it was his birthday, and we attempted to wish him a happy birthday, and we got no reaction. I mean, the last thing that guy is thinking about is like taking congratulations for like a number. The only thing he wants congratulations for is winning. So, well said there. And speaking of Daytona, I want to close out by getting your thoughts on Sunday's race a little bit. Closest Daytona 500 finish in history, Parker. But I know that you are certainly a social media maven and are plugged into what fans are saying on those channels and. I think there was some, I think it's fair to say, disappointment that fewest lead changes since 2009, and there were some fans who asked, you know, why wasn't the action better? What was your opinion of that race and the quality of the race?
I thought it was amazing. You know, one of the cool things about that was that handling mattered. You know, when we went to the tandem thing, the only argument I ever heard and kind of agreed with the tandem deal in the, you know, 2010, 2011, 12, that sort of thing. And as a driver, I loved it because it kind of put my destiny in my own hands. And I could go out there and lead when I wanted to. And you also didn't need a fast car. Well, it wasn't fair to the sport to not have maybe the fastest cars or the best cars or the cars that really prepared and worked the hardest to go out there and have the best shot to win. Because with a tandem deal, you could have a car that really qualified 40th and suddenly was leading the race, right? Did it produce a lot of, you know, different lead changes and such? Absolutely. But, you know, I felt like there was one argument there that was kind of prolific, and that's just that, you know, you weren't talking about a race that mattered to have the fastest car, and that didn't make much sense, right? Mm-hmm. You didn't need the best driver to win the race. And what we've seen in this package, since we've gone to this in the Gen 6 car, I feel like you're seeing kind of the old-fashioned early 2000s, late 90s through speedway racing. It really is. It's about handling. It's about having the best car. You've got to show up to speedway for the best stuff you've got and absolutely go out there and put your best foot forward to have a chance to win that race. And that's the way it should be. You know, it should be the best drivers and the best cars winning that race. That's the way the sport needs to have happened to have legitimacy about the biggest race that we have. I'll just give you an example. After the duels, I was down there hanging out with the two cars team and talking to some of the other teams. And the two car, I asked them, hey, what do you need? And they said, man, we just need a little bit more speed. And you really, if it was the tandem stuff, you wouldn't have heard that. If it was, you know, where we had 19 million lead changes, you wouldn't have heard that. But now they were so focused on finding speed in the race car at a place that we haven't really talked about that in the last few years until we went to the Gen 6. They were talking about finding handling in the race cars come Sunday, right? With the 88 spinning out, the 24 spinning out, the 4 halfway spinning out. I mean, handling was a big deal. I mean, it was absolutely paramount that you had a car that could go up into the draft and stay close to flat out or be playing with the throttle and continually handle well throughout the run of the race. And that was cool. I mean, that's what this sport was built on. That's the basis of it, is building fast race cars that can handle well, driven by great drivers, to go out there and try to win a race. So, and at the end of the day, did we have an awesome finish too? Yes, that was amazing. But I thought some of the driving and as a driver, some of the stuff we saw throughout would have been really cool to be a part of. I personally, as a driver, would have loved to be a part of that Daytona 500 as opposed to, you know, something where it's more of a crapshoot, you know?
Right.
But at the end of the day, you know, we also had a lot of people there. We had, you know, great grandstands packed. I thought it was a great event. I thought it was a really great showcase for our sport. Could there be a tweak to make passing a little easier? Yes. I mean, if the cars created a little bit more drag, I think you would definitely see a little bit more passing. I think you would not see – you wouldn't be able to control the race quite as well as JGR did that we saw. But more kudos to them for working together. I don't think we've seen that really.
Right.
At this level, you know, to really have like that kind of talk. And, you know, crazy thing is JGR has been talking all month about the team, and I really thought that's been amazing. I haven't heard them talk so much about the team, and I think it comes a little bit from, obviously, Toyota, them being the sole Toyota team, really, you know, being so aligned with Toyota. They're the manufacturer's team, and so they've really gotten behind the team aspect of thinking, you know, we want a Toyota to win this race. So that was impressive. But if there was more drag, yes, you would have seen probably more lead changes, and I'm sure NASCAR will continually, as we see all the time, tweak here and there. But I think the package you have now is definitely going to, even as we go along here, going to provide even better racing, knowing that we can make that outside line work.
Yeah, I agree with you on the handling. I think maybe it takes a little bit more of a nuanced understanding. But when you see these guys struggling, who are superstars, struggling with their cars at a track where sometimes it's been too easy to advance your position, that is refreshing. The only thing I would say, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, you mentioned the tweaks. I was just disappointed the outside line just never, even with guys with 4 tires against guys with 2, if you were hugging that inside line, that seemed to be the place to be. Is there anything they could do to address that, do you think?
Yeah, no, they can definitely, it really comes down to just creating a little bit more drag. If the cars are punching a little bit bigger hole in the air, I'm not talking a major move. I'm not talking putting more downforce on them. Mm-hmm. I'm talking just the slightest move, create a little bit more drag. You definitely would find the cars having a better chance on the outside, getting better runs, and the leader wouldn't control the race as much, and that would be a big deal. Right now, the leader really can control the race, and I think with a small tweak, that wouldn't be the case. They would still be able to do what they're doing, but it wouldn't be at the level that we saw, especially in the duels at nighttime and all that grip, where literally the leader was just controlling the race, you know, to the end. I think there's a little bit more drag, and you would definitely see that. So we'll see what they come up with. I think there's no, it's not broken, but it definitely could use a tweak if they want to see more lead changes, for
right,
sure.
Right.
But, and then I think, you know, that's the kind of races, but having that amazing race, you know, I think one of the things that came out was, like, the TV ratings were low for the overnights. And but putting on races like that that get replayed all over the place, that end up on social media all over the place, for the finish like we had, you know, getting people to talk about it in the Spanish version, in the French version that we saw out there, that's cool, and that's what the sport needs, and that's really what's going to grow us. You know, I think that the TV rating things is very short-sighted to look at. I think the, you know, I never look at the here and now. I'm always looking 5 years ahead, and I think when we continually do things like we're doing now, that and have races like that, and continue to make the sport very legitimate in the fact of that the best drivers and the best cars are going to win races and fight for championships, then we're definitely going to continue to find ways to grow down the road. You know, it's not going to be immediate, but right now. And also having facilities like at Daytona. That's one of the most amazing facilities in racing I've ever walked through. I actually watched the Xfinity race from up in one of the suites, and I was sitting there, and I was having a steak that they at a buffet with chicken and all these other great foods and an open bar and everything, and I thought to myself, there's no way I'm sitting at a racetrack. There's no way. I'm at a Cowboys stadium or at a football game, and that's going to become the standard for our sport, and I think that's only going to help it grow as well and have that great fan experience. So that was all positive to me. You know, and I really think if you look at the landscape in motorsports, this is going to be a big, big, I guess, statement.
Right.
But I believe that NASCAR is by far the healthiest motorsport in the world. And there's I can give you numbers continuing to prove it, but at the end of the day, there's no doubt in my mind right now that it's by far the healthiest. And if there's a, you know, racing will always be a bit of a niche sport, but having a niche as large as we do is a pretty good niche.
Yeah, well, no question the overhaul of Daytona was definitely top-notch, received a lot of positive reviews. The other thing that clearly was beyond dispute was that last lap was unbelievable, and that's my last question for you, Parker. I mean, I've watched it a few dozen times, and I've come to some conclusions. What do you make of that last lap? My main question for you as a driver is, did Matt Kenseth make the wrong move, or was there no move he could make to win that race?
Well, I've got two funny things. I had to head to the airport, so I was actually listening on the radio, and my brother and his friend were in the car in front of me listening to the radio as well, because before the race, I told them Denny Hamlin would win this race. And they asked me why, and I said, I called them in the morning, and I said, hey, Denny Hamlin's going to win this race. And so they were interested to see like how that turns out and everything. So we're driving along the airport. I'm listening. I had to listen like the last 30 laps on the radio, which by the way is very exciting. But nonetheless, into it, so I'm going to the airport, and suddenly you know you heard like Denny Hamlin's on the bottom, and then we start get to the end. And you hear Kevin Harvick's coming on top, and I'm like, Denny, move up, do it, just go for it. And sure enough, you hear like Denny Hamlin to the top, here he comes off the bottom, you know. And it was just one of the most exciting things ever. And I started freaking out in the car in front of me when he finally crossed the line. And it was like Denny Hamlin wins. We were honking, and then I obviously got to the airport. I took my phone out and watched like the last 10 laps. Someone had uploaded already, and I really thought that was one of the coolest things I've seen, because he was very reserved, was able to hang out, and then use that one-timed move to the top, get the run they needed, and get that run. What did Matt Kenseth do wrong? I don't know if he did anything wrong, to be honest, because that outside line was coming so fast, he had to do some sort of move to block it, because if he just sat on the bottom, he would have, you know, if he didn't make any move at all, you'd hate yourself more than if you made the move and screwed up. If that makes sense. You know, he tried to stop that line. I think that outside line still would have gotten to him in some capacity had he not moved up anyways, if that makes sense. So they were just coming with such a head of steam that we hadn't seen all day. But you know what? He knows what he was thinking and what he could have done better there. But I truly think he had to make some form of move so that he didn't lose the race just sitting on the bottom with no move at all. And that would be even worse, I think.
Right.
So he gave it his best shot.
Right, right. Do you think it mattered that he didn't have his normal spotter? Do you think that would have been a factor?
You know, I've worked with multiple spotters in my career. Sometimes it's in the same season. And I'll tell you, you know, there is a bit of chemistry there that it's just, it's almost inevitable to have it or not have it. And especially at Super Speedway racing where a fraction of a second makes a difference. If you hesitate for a fraction of a second, you might not get the win or you might not get the move. But I think Matt is an experienced enough race car driver that he had himself in a position to win that race. He put himself, you don't lead the Daytona 500 and run with the way he did without having a good chemistry with your spotter. So, no doubt in my mind, does he prefer the guy that he's had forever, who I've actually worked with, Chris Osborne. We used to call him Crazy. It was his nickname.
Right.
He's a great guy. He's a great spotter. He was my ARCA spotter when he was Kurt Busch's spotter. He is an excellent, he's one of the best in the game, and it definitely is tough at the Cup level to get the quality spotter you want, because if you don't rise, when you're in Xfinity Nationwide, or Xfinity, and you can get all the Cup guys to come be your spotter. But when you get to Cup, suddenly you've got to find your Cup version of spotter, because all the great ones are taken, right?
Right.
So that's a tough thing. So it's hard to even find a replacement guy. But I think, knowing Matt's level of experience, that could have had a small effect, but I really think, looking at who he is, a race car driver, I think, at the end of the day, he saw it coming, he had to make the move.
Yeah, interesting. Good stuff. And, well, we appreciate all that perspective. I know that you had some time in Cup, and so you have some insight into this. You've run the Daytona 500. I hope things work out well with the Truck Series, and maybe we'll see you in that race sometime in the near future again.
Maybe. Thank you very much for having me, and thanks for all the fans listening out there. And here's to the 2016 season. I think it's going to be a great one. So I'm excited to be a part of it on the TV side and working with you, and then also hopefully racing here and there as well.
All right. Thanks again for joining us, Parker. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Nate.
Many thanks to Parker for that. I enjoyed that talk, and I also meant to tell him I will be sticking around Saturday afternoon to watch him at Atlanta Motor Speedway. After being remiss last week at Daytona, not seeing his third place in the truck race, that was a long week at Speed Weeks for me. So I apologize, Parker. I'll try to make as many races as I am able over the remainder of the 2016 season. Okay, next up is, again, Ed Clark, president of Atlanta Motor Speedway. One of, I think, the favorites among track presidents with the beat core that covers NASCAR. Ed Clark always makes time for us. He's a good quote. He's candid. I think that you'll hear that here as we discuss how this weekend is going in year two of this February date, second race of the season for Atlanta Motor Speedway. We also talk about how Ed got into track management and what he worries about during the course of a race weekend. And also, finally, we will get into when will the track repave its surface, which happens to be the oldest surface on the circuit. It hasn't been paved since 1997. A lot of drivers concerned about Atlanta choosing to go that route. A lot of them beg Ed Clark on an annual basis to not touch his surface. So we got into that toward the end of this discussion, and I think the news will be good if you're a fan of Atlanta Motor Speedway's surface. So here's Ed Clark. All right, Ed, well, let's start with, obviously, the big question. This is year two of Atlanta having this race date. How do you feel as if things are going from both a ticket perspective and from a perspective of buzz? What kind of traction do you feel like you're getting in terms of in the market there?
Well, I think as from a ticket selling perspective, I think we're going to be pretty similar to last year, although I expect a significant walk-up in week of sale this year that we didn't have last year. We've got a great forecast. Right now, Sunday's high is predicted to be about 67 degrees and 0% chance of rain. Sunny Saturday, right around the 60-degree mark, so really, really thrilled about that. I think that's going to help our sales this week. We've been gaining a lot of momentum and have beaten last year's numbers actually for now for about 10 days, so looking forward to that, and most of all, from a racing standpoint, no comparison this year. The buzz, especially regarding the low downforce package that we're going to see debut here, it started back in January with the Charlotte Motor Speedway Media Tour, and we've seen it right on through. I can't remember a year, and I've been at Atlanta Motor Speedway 24 years, most of those years with an event coming soon after the Daytona 500, but I cannot remember a year that I've gone in the garage area down at Daytona and had more crew guys and crew chiefs come up to me and talk about their anticipation of coming here to Atlanta, running the low downforce package, really kind of seeing what that's going to look like, because it's going to be used in the majority of the races this year and how it's going to impact the racing this season. I know from the test we had here in October, it's going to be good. We had about six teams in here testing, and really a vast difference the way they run through the corners. They're off the gas a lot longer, pick the throttle up gingerly coming off the corners. And it's gonna provide an opportunity to see some 2 and 3 wide racing this weekend that we haven't seen in a while.
That's certainly good to hear, Ed. As you know, this track was the first place, I think, last year where not just teams but media and fans really got that first sense of what the initial package for 2015 was like. And I can vividly recall that first practice, just the speeds being higher when no one was expecting that with lower horsepower. And I remember Kevin Harvick coming in that night after qualifying and saying 8 miles an hour faster through the corners. What kind of feedback did you get from fans on that last year? I mean, do you feel like NASCAR had to make this move because of what you and they were hearing from people when they looked at how last year's race developed, unfolded?
Well, Nate, I didn't get a lot of feedback after the race relative to how fans felt about that particular race. I think as we looked at what happened throughout the entire 2015 season, it became obvious that we hadn't slowed the cars down. And I'm a total advocate of slower is better. And I hope we've gone far enough with this package. I talked to Steve O'Donnell in Daytona, and he said, look, if we haven't, and we see that, we've already got steps in place to do more. But sometimes you can go forward by going backwards, and by that I mean by slowing the speeds up, you get more side-by-side in competitive racing. And at the end of the day, that's what the fan who pays his money and sits in the stands and watches on TV wants to see, is side-by-side racing. Atlanta Motor Speedway is a track. The asphalt's worn out. It allows these cars to go in the corner, fan out. Some guys go to the bottom, some stay in the middle, some dive to the top. And it's exciting to watch them go 2 and 3 wide through our corners here and at the other mile and a half tracks. And hopefully this package is going to show us that it's going to allow that to happen. Now, I can tell you from the practice last October, corner speeds were significantly lower. They're off the throttle a lot longer through the corner and picking it up gingerly coming off. That should allow for that to happen, not only the first 4 or 5 laps after the green falls, but throughout an entire tire run. And that's what we're trying to get. Last year, I think we had a scramble. The green would fall. Guys raced like thunder for 4 or 5 laps because they kind of knew if they didn't get it then, it was going to be tough after that to do it. When we saw this package, especially like at Kentucky and Darlington last year, you'd see guys back in 10th place battling an entire tire run. And that's what we want to see out of this package, and hopefully we're going to see that come Sunday here in the Quick Trip Polls of Honor 500.
Yeah, no question. And, you know, when you talk about Atlanta Motor Speedway, Ed, obviously it's a favorite track of drivers. They love the fact that the pavement there is so worn out. What do you think of when you market this track to fans? What would you consider to be the Atlanta Motor Speedway brand? How do you sell what kind of product you have there at that mile-and-a-half track?
Well, we've got a new branding position, Atlanta Motor Speedway Classic Southern, and the classic part of it is we've been here since 1960. We're one of the four original super speedways, and we celebrate the fact that we're a southern state. Folks come here from all over the country to attend our events here in the South, and it's where the sport was begun. So I think when people think of Atlanta Motor Speedway, they think of competitive racing. We've had a number of photo finishes. I think 3 of the top 10 closest finishes in NASCAR have been here at Atlanta Motor Speedway. We know we've got a track that will allow that to happen if the right set of circumstances come up. Wouldn't it be great if we had a second photo finish 2 weeks in a row here to follow up the one we had Sunday at Daytona? But I think by and large, they think of us as old, worn-out asphalt surface that guys slip and slide around all day long, and the drivers have a ton of fun doing it, and the fans have even more fun watching it.
And in the past, I think, prior to last year when we thought of Atlanta and the Sprint Cup race, we certainly thought of warmer climbs, but unfortunately, you didn't really have a great weather weekend last year, Ed, and I know that was no fault of your own. That was mainly just a coincidental thing in terms of where it fell on the schedule. I know you guys took a pretty impressive step this year to ensure that fans would have assurances that if there was, you know, a poor weather forecast again, They should still buy a ticket. Could you explain what that policy is this weekend for Atlanta? And the follow-up would be, are you nervously checking weather.com or some other site every other hour to make sure that you're not going to owe a lot of money after this weekend?
Well, Nate, first of all, we listen to our customers. And following last year's, the first event moving up to the second race of the schedule after Daytona, you know, we did have some precipitation, we had some cooler temperatures, and some of our fans, some of our longtime fans expressed a concern about that. So we put our heads together and came up with what we call the perfect race weather guarantee. And it's pretty simple. The average daily high on February 28th here in Hampton, Georgia, is 61 degrees. So we said, if, you know, what's a reasonable, comfortable weather with a jacket, we pick 50 degrees. And we said, if the high, the recorded high in Hampton, Georgia, where the speedway is not 50 degrees on the day of the race, and you don't attend, then we will offer you a credit of the value of your ticket for any other event here in 2016 or the NASCAR race weekend in 2017. And same goes for precipitation. If we have weather, can't run the event on the normal day and run it on a day, Monday, Tuesday, whatever, and you can't be here, then the same thing applies. You get that credit for a future event. And it was all done to take any concern about that away for people who bought in advance of the event. The great news is we wouldn't have done this if it was a 50-50 chance the high wouldn't reach 50. Again, the normal high is 61. We've seen days up in the 70s this time of year. Right now the forecast for Sunday is 67 degrees. And 0% chance of rain throughout the weekend, they're saying right now. So right now I feel pretty good about it. Yes, I've been watching it. Obviously, you don't do something like this and have concern, but it was a pretty low percentage. But most of all, we wanted our fans to know that we hear their concerns, and we're here to make them feel comfortable about any concern they have. We want people to come here and have a great experience. We've worked really hard to provide good old Southern hospitality to the folks who come in. You're going to see some of that this weekend. In some of the programs and platforms we put forth. But that was the basis of the guarantee, and like we hoped, that the law of averages is playing out, and we're in great shape for this weekend as it looks right now.
All right, glad to hear that, Ed, because I wouldn't want you to stress out any more than you already are. I know you got enough stuff to worry about than to also think about the weather.
It's a funny story. The day we announced that, I was going to do a radio interview that night, and on my way I'm listening to the radio, and one caller called in and said, hey, did you hear what Atlanta Motor Speedway is doing with this weather policy? That's a stroke of genius. The next caller called in and said, hey, did this weather policy Atlanta Motor Speedway's done, they're a bunch of idiots. So I guess we'll find out Sunday which one we are, you know, one of the both, maybe both. I don't know, but we're trying to look out for the fans.
All right. Well, I'm glad it looks like it's leaning toward the former at this point. You mentioned, Ed, that the photo finish this past Sunday in Daytona. I always hear these stories, anecdotal evidence, that when you have a great finish like that in a NASCAR Sprint Cup event, that the track the following week tends to benefit. Is that true? And have you seen any evidence so far since Sunday night of the ticket sales picking up because of the Daytona 500?
Well, I've always said talk about the sport is good for ticket sales, regardless what it is. That was a very positive thing. The thing about the Daytona 500, much like the Indy 500, a lot of people watched it, don't watch week in and week out, and they saw our sport on display with a great finish on Sunday. Our sales have been really good now for about 2 weeks. I think some of that was people possibly waiting to see what the weather forecast was going to be, but yeah, we've had good sales. We still have a number of seats to sell, obviously. We won't be sold out Sunday, but I think we're going to top certainly last year's sales, and we're headed in the right direction. We've got some new platforms that we did this year to promote the race. I feel good about the promotional program we've had. And I'm hoping, based on the forecast, we're going to see a huge walk-in crowd, which is not that typical anymore in Sprint Cup racing. But because of the nature of the time of year and everything, I think there's a good chance we could actually have that on Sunday.
Why have walk-up crowds become less frequent?
I think largely because people today make their plans farther in advance. I know I've been in this business for 40 years. There was one time, you know, back in the 80s into the early 90s, you had a lot of walk-up. Then that kind of diminished. But in recent years, we've kind of seen, you know, more people buy later. The trend has kind of shifted. And I think part of that is a lot of new fans are attending. I think as of yesterday, 34% of the folks attending who have bought tickets to date are new customers for us, which is a good, healthy growth percentage, I think. So, and then they typically do buy later and you know, sometimes even race weekend. And so that's probably the reason. You know, some of our sister tracks have their weekend and week of sales have grown percentage wise as well at their events.
That's good to hear. Well, I certainly hope you guys get a decent walk up this weekend, Ed, because as I said, I mean, the track is certainly a favorite among drivers, and it's been a favorite of mine. I've been covering NASCAR full time for almost 14 years, and not to date you, but you're one of the only track presidents I know of that has been in his position throughout my entire tenure on this beat. And you actually precede me by several years as the track president there. You took over in 97. Is that correct?
92. My first 92. Race here. Wow. was the race that Richard Petty retired and Jeff Gordon ran his first race. And so this is my 24th season here at Atlanta Motor Speedway and my 40th season in the business.
Wow. Well, that's certainly a hell of a way to make a debut with that race. How do you – somebody asked me this, Ed, and I didn't really have an answer for it. Becoming a track president, what steps did you take to get to that role, and did you always have that as a long-term goal? When did you set your sights on this being where you wanted to be?
Well, I'll tell you, Nate, it goes way back. When I was 8 years old, I was at the Virginia State Fair in Richmond. I grew up in Virginia, and I was on the Ferris wheel, and cars were in the track taking warm-up laps for a modified race. And the sound and just the energy around it just kind of caught me. The next year, I went to my very first event there at Richmond when I was 9 years old. That was in 1963. Ned Jarrett won that race, and it just grabbed me. And since that time, I've been a diehard fan, and I'm still a diehard fan. Get as excited as anyone attending the event. But I did that, and when I was 15 years old, I worked after school at a biweekly newspaper, and I went in and talked to the sports editor and talked him into letting me go cover races for the paper, believe it or not, at the events at Richmond and Martinsville. My dad had to go with me and sign the release waiver so I could get in, and those guys would give me my pass and kind of give me one of these looks and say, you know, like, don't get run over by a race car. And that's where it started. I went to Virginia Tech and worked for a three newspaper chain there and covered events at Charlotte and Rockingham and Martinsville, Bristol, Richmond. And that's how I got my start. And out of that, actually, about a month before I graduated from college, I started as the PR director at Bristol. Went on later to work at Nashville Speedway and was the track manager there in 1980 and into 81 before I went to Charlotte Motor Speedway in 1981. So it's all I've ever done since a month before I graduated from college, and it's never been like a job. It's just been a labor of love for me.
That's great, and also encouraging that journalist turned track president. I guess there's still hope for me if this doesn't work out then.
There you go. I was actually a horticulture major in college with a minor in journalism, which is a real unusual combination. But we didn't have, you know, sports management and courses like that back in those days. And I always kind of knew what I wanted to do and didn't have that many opportunities back then, but was very fortunate to be given one by Larry Carrier there at Bristol and made the most of it. I worked for some great people through the years, and I'm very, very grateful for the opportunities I've had.
So even though you didn't necessarily study business administration or whatnot in college, it sounds like just having the passion that you have and the knowledge that you have, it sounds as if this is a job that maybe there is, I mean, I'm sure there's some formal training, formal education that you need, but it sounds like more it's a learn on the job and figure out what you need to do type role, huh?
Well, I get asked very often, how do you get into this business? How do you get into this sport? And the biggest thing I tell people is you have to have a passion for it. And if you've got a strong enough passion, you will find a way. You will chart your course. And a lot of people that I've had that conversation with, I look now and they're in their 20s and 30s and working in this sport. And it's something that it's good to see, because I see people with that gleam in their eye that I had back when I was that age and still do, and know they're there because it's where they want to be, and they would just, you know, they're so determined they'd do anything to get into the business. And that's the beauty of it. You know, it's a family. It's like a traveling circus, but we have race cars instead of elephants. And it's people who really, they compete with each other, but we all have a common bond, and we care about each other. And it's pretty neat to have had the opportunity to do this for 40 years and see a lot of those other folks come along and progress and have great careers themselves.
I've got two more for you, Ed. One would be, what keeps you up the most at night during a race week? Is there any one particular thing that you're going to be worrying about this week going into Sunday?
Well, weather's always probably the biggest one that I think any track manager would tell you. The second one for me is, what did we forget? What have we mm-hmm. not spent as much time coordinating this year that maybe we did before? Luckily, I've been here 24 years. We've got a lot of event staff that work for us who have been here doing what they do longer than I have, and they just come and do a great job and represent us well. When you consider, we have 57 full-time employees, and we calculate it takes between 4,000 and 5,000 people to put on a race weekend.
Wow.
That's a very small percentage of full-time employees. So we're really dependent on a great event staff to help us pull these events off. And we've got some wonderful people who help us really take care of our customers. And I don't worry about that as much as I used to. It seems like it happens and it takes care of itself. You always want to be ready to react to anything that comes along. You know, I can tell you there have been race weekends that if I didn't even come to the track, things would have gone perfectly well. And then there have been others that seemed like it was one situation after the other you're running to take care of, and you just never know what it's going to be. But we've got great caring staff members who love this sport, love Atlanta Motor Speedway, want to be here and want to show fans a great time, and just really proud to just be a small part of the operation that takes care of everybody when they come and show them their good time.
Well, one constant that's always been there at that track, Ed, since 1997, of course, is the surface itself, as we've talked about, a favorite of drivers, but also, I'm sure, a little bit of unease when they look around and they see Kentucky repaving, and a lot of other tracks have done that in the last 10, 15 years. Where do you think Atlanta stands right now on that? Is that something you assess each year? Do you assess it after the race, and do you sense that'll change anytime?
Well, Nate, you know, I get asked that a lot because our surface is now 19 years old. I think this is going into the 20th season on it. And one reason it's lasted so long is we religiously walk every inch of the track and outside behind the wall and seal up any cracks that we have usually try to do it around the first week of October every year before winter sets in. And that's protected us from having that moisture getting underneath. At least, you know, we're in Georgia. Pretty mild winters, pretty short winters, so we don't get that heaving some of the northern tracks get. So I think those two things have probably contributed to us being able to go this long. And I really, based on the comments of the drivers who were here in October for the test of the low downforce package, I think we can go another 2 or 3 years before we have to repave, and possibly even longer. And I'll tell you, when I go to other events, or if I go in the garage area this weekend, I will have at least one or two drivers walk up and say, if you touch that track, I'm taking you out. So I'm kind of afraid to do anything. I've said we're going to leave it alone until we have, you know, dirt starting to show through where we've worn the asphalt completely through. But in all seriousness, I think we're in good shape for a few years to come. It's really, you know, as hard as this track is, and it's probably the most abrasive and most difficult for Goodyear to build tires that, you know, satisfy the majority of the teams, to repave and come in and build a tire for it is absolutely the biggest challenge they have on the whole circuit. And so they're encouraging us to let it go a while longer too. But we all know it'll come one day. when we do, the track will be lightning fast, and we'll address that when the time comes. But I think we got a few more years before we have to do anything.
That's good to hear. Yeah, I was going to joke with you that obviously no one is happy about the fact that Tony Stewart isn't racing this weekend, but I'm sure maybe a small piece of you doesn't really mind the fact that he's probably not going to be chewing your ear off saying, don't repave this place, man, if he sees you in the garage this weekend.
I think he made the statement after a race a couple of years ago he would shoot me if we repaved the track. That puts enough fear in me that I hope we can go a while longer.
Yeah, you don't mess with smoke. All right, hey, Ed, I really, really appreciate you making time for us. Very insightful comments that you had, and I wish you much luck and success this weekend.
We're going to have fun, Nate. We're going to have 950 miles of racing, three great events, and can't wait to get it started, get everybody in here, and show the folks who attend the big time. Looking forward to the whole weekend.
We'll see you on Friday, Ed. Take care.